Before we begin, just a quick note. If this conversation about alcohol, identity, and desire resonates, my new book, What Are You Thirsty For? Rethinking Alcohol and the Life You Want, is out now. And if you want to go deeper, slowly, thoughtfully, and in ways that genuinely nourish you, I've opened the Thirsty For More Mindset Lab on Substack. You'll find links to both in the show notes. Right. Let's get on with the episode. Welcome to the Big Drink Rethink, the podcast for anyone questioning their relationship with alcohol or simply wondering what more life might hold. I'm Anna Donaghy, alcohol mindset coach, author, and former strategist. And each episode is going to blend lived experience, psychological insight, and powerful tools to help you understand your habits and gently rethink your drinking in a way that throws open oodles of possibilities. So whether you're trying to quit, cut down, or you're just plain curious, then you are in the right place. Let's rethink things together and explore what you're really thirsty for. So hello and welcome back to the Big Drink Rethink. Now, last week I released a solo episode around avoidance, the art of avoidance, giving it a lofty title. In it, I explore something that many of us are often reluctant to recognize, that avoidance isn't always chaotic. Far from it, it can look like achievement, it can look like competence, it can look like moving forward, until it suddenly doesn't, until the forward motion begins to feel less like growth and more like escape. Now, today's conversation sits directly after that. It asks a question about what happens when avoidance stops working. You know, what happens when the strategies that once protect us stop protecting us? You know, the achievement, the carefully maintained composure. What happens when they begin to fracture? Now, today, my guest is April Day Garcia, author of a very good book called The Room to Be Brave. And what struck me about April's story is not simply that she had an unraveling, but it's the way that she made sense of that. And this is a conversation about what happens when high-functioning avoidance does collapse, and it's about the beliefs that we formed long before we picked up a drink, you know, the emotional ground that we think we might have outgrown, and the possibility that growth and change isn't all about building a better future, but sometimes understanding where it all began. Okay, so welcome to the show, April.
Hello, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Oh gosh, no, you're very welcome. I've been looking forward to this conversation very, very much.
And oh, me too.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's always good when you, you're excited about your own podcast. No, it's, or rather it's bad when you're not. I think that's probably the better. That's a bit of an alarm bell. Honestly, welcome to the show. And before we go anywhere, I think it would make an awful lot of sense if you told us about your book and why specifically the title, The Room to Be Brave.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you again. I want to point out, I love the term unraveling. It's like that. I'm going to use that from now on and be like, oh, you stopped drinking. Well, yes, I had an unraveling.
It sounds more elegant than complete really? Bloody breakdown and collapse, doesn't it?
I completely lost my mind.
I went slight unraveling.
I had a little unraveling. It's beautiful. That's such a great word for it.
It's very British. We look right. To sort of diminish the scale of these things sometimes.
Yeah, it's just a blow.
It's a tad uncomfortable, my unraveling. Yeah.
It's so good. So the book is called The Room to Be Brave. And I wrote it over, 47 years because it's a memoir. But the book is really, it's part memoir, but it's also kind of a map. It's a map of my unraveling, I guess I could say. It's a map of how I became who I am. And it's a journey through the rooms that shaped me. So I see all of my experiences still even as the rooms that they happened in. So when I go back into a memory or something, an experience from my past, I do see the space, the literal space that happened in. And I felt like returning to those spaces and sitting in them was the best way for me to actually cope and work through what happened there. So the book is written as each chapter is a room from an experience that I had to go back and heal from.
That's really cool. It's very smart, actually. It's a sort of, it's more than a metaphor. It provides a brilliant container for the work that you did and you know, set out in a way that's going to help a lot of people I know.
I hope so.
Well, let's talk about it a bit more, because obviously there's lots of questions. There's lots of things I want to ask you. So in the last solo episode, which I've just referred to, I talked about this illusion that forward momentum can be what healing looks like. You know, we just got to keep moving forward. And that if we keep building and moving and achieving, I think there is a strong belief, a strong attempt, maybe more so than a belief, that we can outrun the pain, that we can outrun the discomfort. And I suppose I wanted to ask your experience of that, whether that's what you found yourself doing, and whether there was a moment when you began to sense that that wasn't actually working for you, a moment when you realized that movement itself had become the strategy and it wasn't a brilliant one.
It wasn't brilliant for sure. What's funny about that is that the running and that movement, that forward motion and the achievements and all that, the uncomfortable truth is that it does work. You know, it works for a while, and it worked for a long while, but it works until it just doesn't. So I feel like you do hit a wall eventually. Eventually there is not enough achievement and not enough movement that can keep you from yourself, because the quiet, I feel like, does always catch up with you eventually. I spent years doing exactly that, though, is running. So I ran. I grew up in Southern California, and I moved to Iowa when I was 19, just to get away from my life in California and not have to sit in that. And then in Iowa, I was there for 8 years, and then moved to New York to sort of get away from the version of myself that lived there. And when I moved to New York, I met my husband. I went to college. I had a baby. I bought a house. I started a foundation. I wrote a book. I started a travel company. So I kept the same thing that brought me from California to Iowa and Iowa to New York, and that forward motion and that running from the versions of myself that I wasn't comfortable sitting in, that continued to work. And so I just kept doing it. So I did, if you ask my husband, I have a lot of callings. I have a lot of things that call to me. This is my thing. This is going to be the thing that makes me feel satisfied, and it makes me feel like I have become who I am supposed to become. And I did keep looking outside for that. And that is the running forward, I believe. Sorry, I feel like I'm rambling.
No, you're not. It makes perfect sense. You're sort of literally outrunning, trying in a way, not consciously necessarily, but trying in a way to outrun, you know, first, you know, Southern California, then, did you say Iowa?
Yeah. Yeah. Of all places.
And then New York, and, you know, so there's that, but all the time searching too. So, you know, what am I running to? Looking for purpose, looking for agency, looking for meaning,
Yes. And never actually finding it in the next thing. So everything that I did, when I would start it, whatever the project was, let's say starting the travel company, I was like, this is absolutely the thing and where I'm supposed to be. And I felt so good for a minute and built the whole thing. And I've always feel great building something, building a company or building a project. I always feel great doing that. But as soon as I get comfortable in it and feel like I built the company, here it is, it's made, then the quiet starts again. And then I said, oh, you know what else would be cool? And then my poor husband, every time I'm like, oh my God, I had an idea. And he's like, oh, great, you're going to build something.
Yeah. And here we go again. What are you building this time?
Yep.
Yeah. But I think that's often overlooked, isn't it? That what's exhausting for us can often feel very exhausting for the people around us as well. It's a kind of competency, or, you know, a professional competency that acts as a form of camouflage, right? I think that's often for high functioning people, that avoidance is the competency in what looks like, you know, great performance is a camouflage. And
I get a lot of joy and a lot of distraction from my pain and my history and my life from people saying things like, oh my gosh, look what you've done. And, oh, she's great. She does this and this and this. And I come into a room and people be like, oh, that's April. She did this and this. Isn't it great? And that celebration and that achievement makes me feel like, how could anything really actually be that bad? So all these things that are behind me that I don't want to deal with anymore, they don't mean as much now because I'm doing wonderful things. Look, everyone thinks I'm great. So it is a camouflage. It is like a mask that I wore for a long time, as long as I was doing great things and people thought I was successful and achieving incredible things, I wasn't a mess, right? I wasn't my history.
Okay, that's interesting. So were you also, I'm just trying to sort of think about what this high functioning avoidance looked like, not just moving states and, you know, shifting life in some more dramatic ways and looking for new projects and just throwing yourself off. Were you someone who also found it difficult to sit still?
Oh my God. I use a joke forever that my feet have never touched earth.
Right. Oh, right.
And whether that's because I'm daydreaming about 90 other things or because I literally have not sat still and put my feet to the floor, I don't sit still. I can't watch a movie without writing at the same time or crocheting at the same time. I can't sit still. At all. Never.
So in a way, the high functioning, the performance and the forward movement was allowing you to feel purposeful without feeling vulnerable.
Yes, absolutely.
No room for vulnerability in there at all.
Oh, never. No, never. No. I definitely saw any vulnerability as, you know, a sign of weakness, but also as a sign of, it also brought me back to being, you know, 7 years old or 14 years old or any other time that I had been in a vulnerable state and it wasn't good for me. I think it puts you back into those rooms. So if I'm vulnerable here at 47 in this, whatever it is, in my marriage or in my friendships or just in myself, I'm in a room where I'm vulnerable again. And it does kind of link that emotion to when I felt it before.
The huge, huge feeling of unsafe.
Yes, absolutely.
Huge feeling of unsafe. I mean, vulnerability does feel very uncomfortable. it can do, obviously. But for you, it was just symbolic of moments in time as well when you had felt, quite rightly so, discreet, you know, distinctly unsafe.
Right. And I think of that, it just hit me recently about the idea of PTSD. And, you know, PTSD is, I feel like you are put in a situation or something has triggered a feeling in your body, whether that's emotional or physical or however that shows up for you, that literally puts you, not literally, I hate when I keep using that word, it emotionally or mentally puts you into all of the rooms where you experienced that before.
Right.
So you're in all of those rooms at the same time, and it becomes this overwhelming feeling that you're getting all of it at once, rather than being in the room you're in now, in the experience you're in now, you're in all of them together.
That makes sense to me, the principle of it putting you back in all of those rooms at the same time, and how bloody uncomfortable, you know, all at the same time is the point.
All at the same time, right, becomes overwhelming.
Overwhelming, yeah. So what role did alcohol play in maintaining the illusion that you were coping? Did it numb? Did it postpone? Was it part of postponement, or was it something subtler than that? Do you have a sense?
Yeah, it did a lot of things, actually. I will say that alcohol held a lot of roles in my life. And one of those was definitely numbing for a time. You know, if I was having a bad day or if I had a conversation with my mom that triggered all of these rooms, right? So now I'm in all of these spaces where she disappointed me and I'm feeling it all at the same time. If I had a couple of drinks, it did numb that a little bit. It tampered it down. So I wasn't feeling everything all at the same time. But it only did that temporarily. I would say that those first couple of drinks helped tamper it. And then it kind of almost exploded from the pressure. So then whatever happened after those first couple of drinks made my feelings and my emotions someone else's problem. So while at first I started drinking because I was feeling these emotions and these problems, the more I drank in that setting, I would explode and become angry or sad or, you know, perseverate on things that had happened in my past. And now I'm zero fun, right? Now I'm crying and I'm calling people from when I was like 9 years old and like, you don't understand. So it did help numb for a moment. And at the same time, I guess I could say it would postpone in the same way because I would tamper that down, postpone those feelings till later. But typically what would happen after the fact, so the next day now, is I wouldn't have those same feelings that I had had when I started drinking that day. So whatever it was, say I had an argument with my mother. I drank, I felt better, I drank more, everyone else felt worse. The next morning, I was not upset at my mother anymore. Now I'm upset about this whole other situation that I've created.
Yeah.
So then it became an avoidance. So it did. It played a lot of roles in that way when it came to processing any of my issues, any of my crap. It played a lot of roles in that. But then on the other side, if I wasn't having a bad day and I just was going out to celebrate or have dinner with my friends or whatever it was, it brought me into the group. So then I got to be part of something. So I, growing up, always just wanted to be part of a team or have friends or, you know, I never felt included or like I belonged anywhere. But I'll tell you, I always belonged in a bar, right? As long as people were around me drinking, I always belonged. So there was also a level of, it gave me a sense of belonging.
Yeah.
So it wore a lot of hats, alcohol.
And when did you realize it wasn't actually solving anything? When did you realize that, you know, it wasn't helping? Yes, it may have been creating a sense of belonging in those sort of settings, but actually it was doing more harm than good. When was that?
At some level, I always knew. Mm-hmm. Or at least I knew that it wasn't solving a problem. I don't think I knew that it wasn't, that it was causing a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Does that make sense? So It was never the answer. You know, we always joke that the solution is alcohol, but it's not. It was never the answer. But I never realized it was creating all of these dramatic moments in my life where I was waking up and having to apologize, waking up having to go through my phone and realize like what I had done the night before, who I had offended, who I had hurt, and then carrying all of the issues from that too. So growing up believing I didn't belong and growing up believing I was a burden and not feeling connected to people. Now having all of these situations where I was waking up feeling rejected and feeling like I didn't belong again and feeling like I was a burden and I was bothering people, it perpetuated this cycle of now I need to drink to erase that feeling, which just creates more of that feeling.
Yeah. So. One of the things that strikes me is that we said it at the beginning of this conversation, avoidance works until it suddenly doesn't,
mm-hmm.
until the strategy stops holding or what stops holding up, really. You know, it's creating, as you know, new situations, different situations. It's just bringing different types of discomfort into your life.
Right.
For some people, that's really dramatic. It can be a crisis. It can be an absolute massive bust up or a health scare. But for others, and I think sometimes more commonly, it can just feel, it's quieter and it's a slow erosion and it's this sense that the life you've built feels really disconnected.
That's exactly it. There was a huge disconnect in who I knew I was, like who I'm as April, as like at my core. I know that I have a lot of light in me, right? I'm very positive. I carry a ton of hope.
You strike me as a very positive person, I have to say.
Thank you. But you should see me when I was drinking. I had no, you know, that was the disconnect, is there was this darkness that lived in me as well. So I carried all of this darkness, but then I was like fighting to be this hopeful light person. So, but I didn't see that they were there was this battle going on, and where, you know, some people do have this like big rock bottom moment. I definitely had some of those that I should have recognized, and they should have been rock bottom and they weren't, but it did become more of a slow erosion.
It's different for everyone. It is different from everyone.
But I feel like that dark was starting to take over more of who I was. And when I started to recognize that I was being lost, the light was being lost to the darkness, I didn't want that anymore.
No.
And I could see it reflected in my family. And I think that's when it finally was like, oh God, what am I doing? I have a beautiful life. I really do. And if you read the book, it didn't start that way. It was pretty heavy and very small. And I had to overcome a lot of challenges. And now I have a beautiful family. My husband is incredible. My daughter is, that girl walks on water. So I could see my darkness reflected in how they looked at me. And that was, I'd say that was a huge moment when I noticed that.
That was the kind of the clear rupture for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is different, obviously, for everyone. I remember the avoidance, the realizing that my strategy wasn't working anymore. I was just exhausted, you know, from holding everything together. I've spoken about not recognizing myself in the mirror. Not wanting to look in the mirror, having no respect and love for the person sort of looking back at me, and also knowing in my heart that they were a shadow, you know, that I was now a shadow of that, you know, the former self.
Right. That's the darkness, right? Taking it's over.
The darkness. I hadn't called it that myself, but I do like the way you say that. And my husband, you know, reflecting stuff back to me that you can't ignore anymore. It just becomes unsustainable, and that realization that the emotional costs far exceed any return that you're getting.
And they know you, right? So, like, I know my, you know, you know yourself, but I feel like you can lie to yourself a little bit more. That your spouse knows who you are at your best, and they know who you are at your worst, and they see you as a big picture, where maybe we see ourselves more in the moment. You know, I can look and I guess, oh, I've done this, this, and this, but in the moment I'm this. But my husband sees the big picture. And so he knows I have greatness and he knows I have light, but he's seeing that difference. You know, I feel like they just see us way better than we see ourselves sometimes.
Oh yes. Oh yes. And you know, that's powerful, you know, for those of us who are lucky to have someone like that in our lives who can point those things out. And recognize that in us is lucky.
It's
such a privilege. So let me just ask you, what did you do first, April? Did you decide to re-enter those rooms, or did you give up drinking first?
I gave up drinking first. Mm-hmm. I had an episode a couple of years back where life kind of caught up to me. And I couldn't run anymore. Literally, I had a broken hip and I was non-weight bearing. I was stuck. I couldn't run at all. I was stuck in my house. I wasn't working. I wasn't creating anything. And I was so depressed, just really beyond depressed, because I identified as somebody who was always doing and going and moving and being. And now I was stuck and I didn't recognize my body anymore. And I didn't recognize who I was becoming. And I was drinking pretty heavily to ignore the thoughts of I'm a burden. I am in the way of my family's happiness. I'm not all these great things that I thought I was. Look at me. I'm a piece of crap laying on the couch. Can't move. Can't even go up and down the stairs to do the laundry. I literally was useless. So in this moment, this day that I had.
Can I just point out that you had a broken hip? You can be excused for not being able to go up the stairs and do the laundry, but I'm taking your point.
Actually, you know what's funny is my husband helped me. He put rollerblade wheels on my office chair because we have wood floors in our house, and I would roll around the house and vacuum.
Like, he's like, damn it, woman, you are doing the housework.
Yes, I was like, I can't live like this.
You think but a broken hip is an excuse?
Right. So what if you're on crutches? Make me dinner. No, God, he would never. He's going to hear this and be like, April Garcia. he's like, you begged for those wheels. So I was stuck, right? So I'm stuck in my house. I'm stuck on the couch and I'm having all of these thoughts of who am I if I am not mobile and constantly creating? And I felt like I was nothing. There was nothing if I wasn't that. So I drank so much. I drank so much that night and I drank to quiet all of those voices, right? All of these negative thoughts and the spiral of that. And it was the faster the thoughts came, the faster the drinks came. And then that cycle just got worse and worse. And that particular night, I didn't think I could do this anymore. And I think divine intervention for stopping me from stopping on my way to bed. And when I got to bed that night, I told my husband, I said, you know, Rick, I love you. And I might have taken all the Xanax and I might not have. Like, I legitimately don't remember, but I'm going to bed. And I went to sleep. And thank God that I didn't actually stop at the medicine cabinet. And I wasn't actually, it's so funny, it sounds so dramatic, this whole moment, right? But I wasn't intending to be dramatic. I literally just didn't remember. That's how much I had drank, because I didn't remember the hobble from the couch to the bed. Mm-hmm. But I knew I had considered it. My husband, the next morning, he sent me to the hospital, rightfully so. And I had time to just be and just exist and kind of heal from this hangover that I had. And in what you wouldn't think is quiet, because it's the emergency room in New York, is, you know, in anywhere, but it was chaos around me. But for me, it was a chance to be quiet and sit in just myself. And it was in that moment that I was like, I have got to deal with my stuff, because there's no part of me that wants to die. Mm-hmm. There was no part. I just needed a minute, right? And I felt like life wasn't giving me that minute, but at the same time, even if it had, I wasn't taking it, because I did have a minute. I had a broken hip. I couldn't go and do anything. And instead I just drank that time away. So I took that minute, that 8 hours in the emergency room, and I was like, I need to figure out why I'm feeling this way and why I'm doing all of these things. And while I didn't stop drinking at that point, I did started therapy and I started antidepressants because I was clearly going through something. And I started to kind of work through my stuff, but I never really fully dove in, because I didn't have the capacity while I was still drinking. Mm. I didn't have the clarity, and I was still adding to my dark rooms, and I was still creating these spaces that I needed to heal from as long as I kept drinking. So when I finally decided to stop drinking, it was really just, there was a night that I drank too much and I was a jerk. And the next morning, my husband was sleeping in another room, as he did a lot of times when I drank too much. And I went into the room where he was sleeping. And I say this often, but that walk of shame in your own house, just, it hits so differently. And I had to go into him and apologize again. And the disappointment, the disappointment on his face was not just like, my wife disappointed me again. The disappointment was, this is going to be my life. It was like so much bigger than that one night. So I stopped. I said, I'm done. I don't want to walk in here and do this anymore. I don't want to have this feeling of the weight and checking my phone and trying to figure out what I did and who I offended. I don't want to do it anymore. And once I stopped drinking and took a few weeks to kind of like come back to myself and realize this is real, I'm doing this, and realize that I actually did have a problem. That was another big thing, is realizing if you need to stop, it means you had a problem in the first place. Once I got through all of that, I was like, you know what? I'm going to heal my trauma. It was just like one of those things, like, I'm going to start a business. I'm going to heal my crap. So I started doing research, and I don't know if you've ever worked through or tried to work through your stuff, but there are 9 million different ways to heal trauma. And I was looking at retreat. I'm going to go on a weekend retreat and they're going to fix everything and I'm going to be fine. I read a lot of books and I went to therapy and I tried meditation and I do Reiki. And there are all these different ways that I tried to go back and heal from what had happened to me. And none of it was I'm going to go sit in the room, until I realized that's exactly what I was doing. So I finally realized that I had been telling my stories of traumas and my experiences as a bystander. Like I was telling it like I had seen it on TV, right? So I never was experiencing the moment. So I went, when I actually did go in and sit in the space of those experiences and felt what I needed to feel to move through it, it was life-changing.
So what we're talking about here, just to be clear, we're talking about the rooms, right? We're talking about the rooms now, not just as a sort of as a metaphor for, you know, as avoidance. These are the places where beliefs were formed, where the trauma happened, yeah?
Yes.
Can you explain that, what these rooms represent for you?
Absolutely. So these rooms are the literal spaces that my experience happened. So if we take just one particular experience to kind of move through, there was, when I was 14, I had to turn my mother in to the police for child abuse. So the room that the abuse happened in is a room that I couldn't think about. It was a room that, and that was my childhood bedroom. So it's not like it was a room that couldn't, I never had to go or never had to exist in my memories, but I had a lot of trouble with that space. But with the other side of that is I could tell you exactly what happened, like I was reading off a menu, but I couldn't actually feel that space. So that room, the police station, the room I was in there, those rooms have become these spaces in my mind and in my soul that I have locked up and decided never to return to. I don't need them. If I don't go back, I don't have to feel them. And when I finally decided to go back and sit in those spaces metaphorically, because they've long since sold that house, I can't go back and sit in it. That would be weird. Can I just sit in your kid's bedroom? I'm doing a thing. So I would sit in these rooms through meditation, journaling, and talk therapy and all these different ways to actually sit mentally and emotionally in the space and process what happened there. I could see it from a different perspective. You know, going back, I think we think of the spaces where our traumas happen. And a lot of times when I tell people about the rooms, they're like, oh, no, I could never go back into a space where I was hurt, because we're afraid that it's going to feel the same way it did the first time. So the pain and the heartbreak that I felt at 14 is what I expect that I would feel if I went back at 47.
Of course, yeah.
Right,
yeah,
and that's why nobody goes. You lock the door because you're like, I'm not going to feel that again. That was horrifying. But the truth is, when you go back as 47, it's not the same, because the violence is not literally happening to me now. The emotions are there, but they're so much less than the power that we give them. And I think avoiding it gives it that power.
Yeah. The avoidance is almost holding it, freezing it as a moment in time, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And freezing you are parts of you as that version. So parts of me, parts of my soul and my psyche are stuck as this 14-year-old girl who's in this room with her mother experiencing this moment. So going back and sitting in that room and being with that version of myself allowed me to finally integrate that and bring her forward. Mm. And that was huge.
And you say this was through various forms of meditation or talk therapy.
Yes.
General forms of therapy.
Yeah. So like I was saying before, there's so many different ways to heal your trauma. And I did find that that was the case, but I had to find the things that worked for me, because one practice, one modality does not work there are so many different levels to what we experience that I think you do kind of have to hit it from different angles. Mm. So the talk therapy allowed me to say the things out loud and get somebody else's professional's perspective on it. So, you know, when I told that story in therapy, for the first time when I was able to say it out loud and feel it, my therapist was able to say to me that that room and that experience wasn't about you. And that was because of your mother and what she was dealing with. And so that gave me a different perspective. And then meditation allowed me to sit in the space with that little girl and actually mentally put myself in the room with the blue carpet and the pink daybed and, you know, the nail polish stain next to the dresser. And I could sit in the space and sit with that little girl through meditation. And then journaling, I feel like journaling is therapy without performance. You get to just...
It's a hell of a lot cheaper too.
Oh, it's so much cheaper. Although I do have a lot of journals. So yeah, I buy a new one that's probably weekly.
Exactly.
But you find answers to things in journaling that I feel like you can't get anywhere else, because there are a lot of answers you have in yourself, right?
They're in yourself. Come out exactly. In journaling. Exactly.
Yeah. So all of those different levels helped get me back into the space where I could heal.
So I'm really curious, this is a bit of an aside question, but I'm really curious, one therapist with many approaches or lots of different therapists?
I've had a couple of different therapists, and I think that's just a matter of finding who's serving you at that time.
Because I think that can be quite bewildering for people as well, though, because there are, as you say, there are so many flavors of therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And you think to yourself, you know, first of all, I've got to have a hunch as to which one might be the most appropriate one. And then I've got to find someone in my locality and then
my insurance.
Bond with them. And then I've got to be able to afford them. And then I might get so far down the road and they're not going to be the right type of therapy or the wrong person. And it can just feel like, oh,
right.
But this is why I was, you know, you do get therapists who have many different practices, many different approaches within their sort of on their therapy tool belt, as it were. Mm-hmm. So I just wondered whether you kind of got lucky and found someone who could unlock a lot of things for you, or whether it was a bit of a trial and error.
So there were a lot, you know, I had a few different therapists depending on the time and when I was working through. When I gave up alcohol, actually, I found a therapist, and he was retired NYPD. So he was a police officer, and he did therapy and counseling for other police officers and families of 9/11 victims and trauma survivors through the NYPD, which is bananas. So when I met him, and he was also a recovering alcoholic. So when I met him, he heard my story. That's, you know, in the book, basically. I basically told him the book. And he was the first person that I felt like could handle all of the different parts of my traumas, because I did have a lot of different types of things happen to me, almost to the point where you're like, really? Another thing? And he got it. And he also got it from the perspective of alcoholism. And so he was hugely beneficial for me when I was
getting
up alcohol. Yeah. And eventually I did outgrow that, because then the focus was so much on the alcohol and the recovery and less so on the traumas. So I did end up outgrowing him. I'm in the market now for a new therapist, but I found that I did work through a lot of my stuff with the tools that he gave me, with the tools from my original therapists.
Great.
Yeah. And the books. I read so many books.
Oh, yes. Well, there are so many books out there to read on this subject. Which were the hardest rooms to re-enter? April, I know that as soon as I've asked you that, I can be quite a confronting question, but you've obviously written the book now. So I'm assuming you're able to talk about them.
Absolutely. You know what's funny is the book, the chapter that I almost didn't put in the book, I would say, is the one that was the hardest for me to confront. And my husband is the one who encouraged me to do that. And that is the chapter of where I screwed up a lot of times. So I feel like it's easier to point the finger outward and be like, oh, look at all of these things that these people have done to me. And look at all these traumas I experienced. Oh, poor me. But when I had to turn the lens inward, that sucked. That was really hard.
That is the hardest. That is the hardest. It's almost in therapy terms as well, it sort of touches almost on the shadow work and all the very difficult, you know, to go places. Yeah. The things that we don't like to see in ourselves.
Yeah. And you know what happened? My husband was like, oh, did you put in the book that story about when you fell asleep on my parents' porch at a party? And I was like, ugh. And he loves to tell that story. He thinks it's funny. Oh, no. He's like, oh my, he didn't think it was funny then, but now, oh, you know, 20 years later.
Story again.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh my God. And I was like, and then he mentioned another story and he goes, did you tell that story? And I was like, no. And I started to get frustrated. I was like, no, I didn't tell that story. You know why? Because there's hundreds of those stories and they're not funny to me. These are not funny moments of my life. These are embarrassing and humiliating. And then that was at night. And the next morning I woke up and I was like, son of a bitch, I got to put the stories in.
You got to do it. Yeah.
I got to do it. And then I realized because touching on those stories had such a reaction from me, it meant that I wasn't through them yet. I hadn't gone into those rooms and really looked at what happened and what I had done and why I had done it. And so I really started to look at that. And once I started to heal from those spaces and started to treat myself with a little more kindness and forgiveness and understanding and grace. Oh my gosh, so much grace. That's when I could put those chapters in. So that I think was the hardest thing is admitting, you know, yeah, a lot of other people did some pretty terrible things, but so did I. And God, I hope nobody is like getting the itch to write a book that I'm in, because that would be, be horrible, because I could be the villain in some books, I'll tell you.
Well, you're thinking, at least if you are, please don't ask my permission. I don't want to know about it.
Yes. Change my name.
When you went back into these various rooms, what did you discover about the beliefs that you formed there?
Yeah, most of the beliefs that I had about myself were total crap. Mm-hmm. So they were not true and they didn't come from me. So I think a lot of the beliefs that I carried for decades came from what I thought other people thought of me. Mm-hmm. So I was taking this image of myself from other people who are flawed and not healed and have their own rooms they're carrying and that they've never worked through, and they're putting their image on me and I'm carrying it like it's true. So I believed I took up too much space, and I believed that if I was good enough or successful enough or helpful enough, it was the only way I held value. I believed that I didn't necessarily belong to anyone or in any space. So those beliefs, I've been carrying those since I was a child. I would have never created that for myself, right? Like, I would have never been like, look at my 7-year-old curly haired little self and been like, girl, you are a problem. Like, no.
Yeah. Well, the reason I asked that is because on the face of it, someone listening to this could be, God, this sounds like hard work, you know, going back. Why would you do that to yourself?
Sounds like a nightmare.
Going back to all of these rooms that have represented different traumas for you, and some of them are really, really hard to enter. And some, you know, there you are with your younger self. And goodness me, this sounds like, you know, a hell of a journey. Mm-hmm. But it also sounds to me, particularly when you say, you know, you discover that the beliefs just weren't true and you had carried them for years and years and years. So these places might have been very painful rooms to re-enter, but in a way very foundational too, because they're spaces where you could end up rewriting your identity, realizing that it's, you know, if the beliefs underpinning your identity and your self-beliefs aren't true, then there's space to recreate.
Yes. And that's an interesting word too, like recreate, because I don't know if it's particularly accurate in the way that a recreation, I feel more like all of these things were put on me, right? All of these beliefs were put on. So there's this little me and then all these beliefs piled on top of me, and the work is chipping them away to actually get to the real me. So the me I was supposed to
still
be
there,
right? So yeah. I'm in there. I'm just finding her. I'm peeling away the layers that aren't mine, that don't belong to me, that someone else put there. and I'm not wearing them anymore. I'm not taking them with me anymore. So I get to decide now what moves forward. So all of those, the choices that were made for me at 7 or 14, or, you know, even choices that I made based on belief systems that I shouldn't have ever carried.
Yeah.
Those were not my choices. Now I get to move through and essentially redecorate those rooms. And I get to,
it's a nice way of looking at it.
Right. And I get to pick
open
the
windows and, yes, you know, let throw in some open light. The windows and let in some light.
Yes. And I get to pick the rooms I go in moving forward, which is even cooler because, you know, in 10 years, the rooms I'm going into now are going to be memories and they're going to be my new belief system. And why don't you want to write that as positively and as brightly as you can?
Mm. Right. Well, that's the profound shift, I think, in your story. And it struck me when I was looking through your book is that, you know, it's this shift from escaping to returning. And it comes up so often when I talk to people who are in the throes of doing the work, as we call it, which makes it sound very arduous, but it's so liberating. any type of work to unpeel the layers and heal or grow, whichever term you want to put to it, is this idea that it's not about reinvention. It's not about renewal. It's not about creating anew. It's about returning to who you were and how you fundamentally saw the world before the bad shit happened.
Yes.
And you talk about, you know, the sort of picking away the layers. It sometimes, I love a metaphor, and it sometimes feels like, you know, the person who's been fossilized inside these layers that then you almost have to sort of, you talked about chipping away at the rock. It's just about getting back to that, isn't it? Getting back to the person inside.
I heard this, I wish I could remember his name. He's a motivational speaker. He was a Navy SEAL, and he talks about what got him to, because he was like this overweight video gamer, you know, teenager, and he ended up a Navy SEAL. So, you know, talk about like a shift in direction. And he talks about how when he gets to the end, so whatever that looks like for you, if it's heaven or, you know, whatever the end looks like for you, and they bring out like the, this is your life. And they have this board of all of the things that you were supposed to do, right? So he was supposed to become a Navy SEAL and he was supposed to become this motivational speaker. But had he not done the work, he would have been video game couch potato guy. And he would have gotten to the end and saw the board and been like, ah, crap. I was supposed to be a Navy SEAL. And this, and not just that, but, you know, the lives he's changing through speaking and writing. And he could have been all of these things, but you didn't do the work. So now you are video game guy. Right. And that,
yeah.
That perspective, when I heard that a couple of years ago, it sits with me. It like lives rent free, right? Is that it's not becoming someone new. He didn't become someone new. I haven't become someone new. I actually am doing the thing I'm supposed to be doing. Yeah. I'm just taking away all that other excess crap.
I'm going to start saying something now, which I know I'm not going to be able to finish because I can't remember the story. But there's what you're saying reminds me so much of that. There was I'm sure it was Michelangelo who was chipping away at a big block of ivory or big block of stone one day in his workshop. And someone said, came in and referred to this big block of stone that he was chipping away at. And he said, no, it's a horse. And it was this idea, he's removing the bits that aren't the horse.
Yes.
And I just remember thinking, I'm sure someone's going to write in and go, what a load of twaddle. It wasn't a horse. It wasn't Michelangelo.
It was like David.
But whatever it was, it reminded me that it was something, basically the idea was it's something inside. And you're removing the bits that are excess. You're removing the bits that have just created a lump. And yes. Your inside is this most beautiful thing. So April, when you look at your life now, it doesn't feel like you've become someone new. It sounds to me as though this whole process for you, first the work and then the writing, has meant that you've just become someone more integrated. You've integrated all of that. I'm mm-hmm. sure the work is ongoing.
Yes. Oh, for sure.
For sure. But it I think that's the process, isn't it? It's about the integration.
Yeah. I mean, there's still moments where I'm 7 years old, right? Because she's still here. There's still moments where, you know, I feel pain from things that happened, and life is still lifing too. I mean, I still have experiences that come up that are hard that I am like, oh, great, here we go again.
Yeah.
And so I'm not ever going to be done working through the rooms of my past and continuing to move forward in a way that's, you know, I'm doing it consciously. And as the April I want to be and the April that I really truly am, it is still work. I think we need a new word for that.
I'm like, I know, it just sounds so mild. Why would I want to do that?
Yeah, the work makes it feel heavy. It is work, but I think it sounds overwhelming when you look at it as a whole picture. Like, look at all the work she did. It's a whole book. Oh God.
Mm,
yeah. But it didn't happen that way. So it happened in moments. You know, it happened when I sat down with a journal or when I went to therapy and I worked through a room at a time. And it took a lot of time, but that time was passing anyway, right?
Yeah,
so I could still be that disaster I was 3 years ago, or I could be doing what I'm doing now.
This is what I said to someone the other day who was, you know, almost sort of slightly ambivalent about doing the work to help with drinking. And I said, they said, it sounds, you know, it's all standard. Well, but it is tiring. It's hard work. But it's also hard work being stuck in a drinking problem.
Oh, the worst.
Do you know what I mean? It's awful.
Right.
It's
choose your hard heart.
Work. Choose right? your heart.
Choose exactly. your heart.
Choose your heart. Because we literally were. I'm debating that. And I said to me, well, look, my exhaustion came from the incredibly hard situation of being stuck day in, day out in something that was tearing strips off myself. Or mm-hmm. you can apply the same amount of energy, if you like, to something that's going to get you out of.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And somebody asked me recently, like, how do I feel different? And I'll tell you that 1000% I do, because when I was still drinking and I was still carrying all of this hurt, I felt almost, and I don't know if you could relate, but I felt like electricity almost in my body all the time, like static, like nothing was connected and nothing was settled. And now the feeling I have in my body is, I guess, normal. I don't know. Grounded. I don't feel that static and that discomfort and that dis-ease all the time anymore. And it did take time, but it just kind of, I didn't notice that the feeling had changed until someone had asked me that question. And I was like, oh, wow. I don't feel like chaotic anymore, like frenetic and like blah all the time. I feel settled in like the best way.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm very conscious of the time. So
I didn't even notice.
Well, that's what happens, isn't it? It's sort of just get into a really interesting conversation. If someone listening recognizes that they're perhaps, you know, let's use the metaphor, they're in the hallway, you know, they're in the hallway, skillfully coping, moving forward, avoiding certain doors. There's lots of them there, but they're avoiding it.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to someone whose sort of temptation is to just loiter in the hallway? What would you say to them about maybe just entering one room? Not all of them, but maybe just one.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say, you know, kind of what we just were saying is like, choose your heart. Like the hallway can be it can be harder even because it ends up like that hallway from like a nightmare where it just continues forever and ever. And you're on that same trajectory. So choose a room. Don't choose all of them. You can't do that. Choose one, and maybe don't choose the biggest one. Choose one that's, you know, I felt uncomfortable in this moment, and go back and work through that specific room first and use the tools, you know, find a therapist, do the meditation. I know nobody knows how to meditate. You can meditate, do it.
Yep. Yeah.
Same with journaling. You know how many journals start with, I don't know why April makes me do this, but it works. So do the work and find a better word for it than work.
Oh, thank you so much for coming on. There's something so deeply hopeful about this conversation. You know, avoidance isn't failure. You know, it's protection. It's what we do when we don't feel safe enough to enter the room. But I think, you know, what we've talked about today is that healing or growing and changing isn't about building a better hallway. It's about discovering it's about discovering that the rooms we feared most are potentially not the same rooms as we left behind. And it's often where our truest self is waiting.
Yeah, it's waiting right there for you. Like, go get her.
April, thank you so much. Where can people find you?
So I have a website, aprildegarcia.com. My book, The Room to Be Brave, is on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And in the US, we have thebookshop.org. I don't know if you guys have that, but it supports your local bookstores. So I'm all over there.
We have similar. Yes, exactly.
Oh, excellent.
So, yeah.
The Room to Be Brave on social media.
Amazing. April, thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you for listening and getting curious. Please rate, review, and follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you're choosing to listen. It really helps other people find the show. And don't forget to tune in to the next episode. And you can find all of my resources and become part of The Big Drink Rethink by heading to my website, thebigdrinkrethink.com.